Russ Tronsted is at the University of Arizona and is an outreach professor and extension specialist in the Department of Agriculture and Resource Economics. He was raised on a ranch in rural Montana, and from working with Russ, it is true, you can take the man out of Montana, but you can't take Montana out of the man. So, and we're pleased about that. Some of us have a special place in our heart for Montana, but he was on a cattle and grain ranch that had both irrigated and dry land acreage. And Russ's excellence has been recognized. He's received a number of awards and is presently specializing in working with small-scale specialty producers, both commercial and small-scale, in that area. His curriculums he's developed, Western Profiles of Innovative Agricultural Markets, Examples of Direct Marketing and Agritourism Enterprises. So he's well qualified this morning to talk to us. So Russ, it's yours.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here, and I just hope that I can keep everyone engaged here. It's hard to imagine what everybody's looking at and what everybody's doing out there without an audience here, but I can tell by the attendee list that there's obviously a lot of people there that are very qualified to also talk on this subject, and I'm sure I could learn a lot from everybody in the audience as well. But just to give a little outline of some things I plan to go over here this morning or afternoon, wherever you may be, but just to talk a little bit about, you know, niche versus commodity marketing. I know yesterday, Ed and Dylan, a lot of the things that they were talking about in terms of marketing had to do with, you know, somewhat of forward pricing, kind of timing the market, you know, not necessarily hoping for the high price of the year, but having a plan to market at a good seasonal price. Whereas some of the niche marketing here that we'll look at is somewhat of a different strategy in the sense that we're trying to differentiate the products so that we're able to get a different price than the same thing that's going on with the commodity market. Obviously, third-party certification is a part of that in terms of verifying to consumers that you don't know, you know, how your product is grown and what the attributes of your products are. Organic being one of the more common third-party certification things. We'll look at that some. We'll look at some of the direct marketing trends that have been going on for agriculture and producers. And then I'm going to pull up a couple producer examples here from some producers in southeastern Arizona. Just tell some of their story a little bit in terms of how they view their niche and the way they're approaching their marketing, and just talk about some resources that are available for us as we look into this area of niche marketing. Well, I guess to start here, in terms of niche marketing, what do we kind of mean? I guess, usually I like to think of it first in terms of like product-service combination. You may differ different from what mainstream providers or others are providing. You might think of organic apple, at least at one point being somewhat of a niche there. As you know, it's growing, so the niche might be disappearing. You find that niche by saying you had a hippic operation where you also have cannabis. And so different things that you can do that make you unique from what mainstream is doing. Also, in terms of their niche, I think is focusing on the target customers. You could have a geographic area, you know, a narrow geographic area within, you know, 50 miles of your place or something. Then, if you're targeting that group, that gives you somewhat more of a niche than others, the rest of the competition around the U.S. The demographics within that area could be the ethnicity of the group. It might be even just things of like you could be targeting even like, say, children, school bus tours. I know some people in the area have found that school bus tours are a good way to get started in terms of kind of doing recreation and selling directly on your farm, because you have good control of what the audience is going to be. You know how many are going to show up. When you're starting into the direct farm marketing, you open up the gates of your place, you don't know how many people are going to show up necessarily, and you might get overwhelmed. So that's one way I think some people have gotten into kind of starting in on a smaller scale with some of the school bus tours. So in essence here, then, you want kind of a combination of your product service attributes and your customer profiles that is somewhat unique that defines your market niche. So within that, I guess we look at what are some of the challenges here for this niche marketing approach. And probably one of the first challenges would be just to find a market segment that is, you know, small enough that mainstream has kind of overlooked it, but yet also large enough to be profitable. If it's a real small market, I mean, it's going to be hard for you to create enough volume and economies of size to, you know, make it viable for your business. Next, I guess I think important to keep in mind with niche marketing is that the repeat customers are key for it, because it's a small market. You want to be sure you've got these target customers coming back to you. So you want to pay attention to your repeat customers. And also, if you're in part of a growing market, that is helpful, because it is a small market. If the base is growing, that's going to help you in terms of being successful with your niche marketing. And probably one of the, I think, most important things to think of in terms of a niche market is, you know, why have others not already taken advantage of your identified niche market? If you've found this, what you think is going to be a new niche, how come, you know, ask yourself, how come somebody hasn't already gone out there and taken advantage of this niche? And that's where your uniqueness can fill in that void and say, I have certain attributes on my place that nobody else has, whether they might be cost advantages or different locational advantages, or even just your farm story, with sometimes in terms of your heritage that belongs to your place that you can sell that nobody else can sell. And to kind of put this into a graphical perspective here, I guess if we think of in terms of the two areas where ag is growing, we think of it being over here with where we have our large-scale commodity growers over here, where we have a farm size that's very large, and they're producing essentially a homogeneous product like commodity. And this, you know, fits in with the area where Dylan and Ed were talking about yesterday with some of the livestock marketing and grain marketing. This area is growing here, these large producers. Also, there tends to be growing in agriculture here in terms of the smaller producers to mid-size that are producing a differentiated product here, and be it value-added activities or tourism or different things that they provide with their product to differentiate themselves from the mainstream producers. And I guess if we look at how people do get sometimes set apart, if you don't know your consumer and you're trying to reach out to a broad audience, labels, third-party certified labels are one way that you can kind of reach out to these consumers and set yourself apart from the competition. You can just look here, Fair Trade Certified here. That's a logo that you'll often see out in the grocery store, whatnot, on how the product is being grown in a way so that it's been fair to labor practices. You can also think of in terms of being friendly to animals, the certified humane, so that it's been raised in a way that's been favorable to animal treatment. So these are attributes we would call credence attributes, in the sense that you can't verify this by looking at the product or actually consuming the product, but they can only be verified in terms of the production process. So there, and also you think of our kosher labels and whatnot. These are things that are gaining in popularity, actually, not just so much for religious reasons, but also for in terms of food safety reasons, in terms of believing that the process has gone through more scrutiny as it's being being refined and processed. So these are one way that people have used to distinguish themselves from the competition and certification. And we've got a publication that we worked on with I worked on with others in the Western Extension Marketing Committee here, called the Certification and Labeling Considerations for Agricultural Producers. And one of the diagrams that I like in there, in terms of in this publication, is Gene Kinsey's Hierarchy of Consumers' Food Preferences here. And just to note that as incomes have increased, there's a certain portion of individuals across the U.S. in particular here that have moved beyond just paying for convenience and affordable and whatnot, and they're actually willing to pay for things related to status and causes, which would be like animal welfare, growing food that's better for the environment in some cases. The argument given for organics. So in addition to just the health of the own individual, there can be other attributes that are brought in there that people are willing to pay for, and certification is a part of that. So I put this up as kind of a resource for further reading that you could look into in terms of looking at ways to differentiate yourself and make a market niche. If we move on here to like organics being one of the most popular programs, I guess, for third-party certification and verification, if we look at here kind of the market penetration here of organics from 1997 up through last year, 2008, you can see that organic in terms of dollars of food sales has gone from, you know, about 0.8%, less than 1%, up to around 3.5%. So organics has been growing, and it's still been growing at a not as fast as it was in recent years, but from the basic numbers I can find here, we're still growing this is at a double digit rate here. And even in spite of the, you know, kind of the downturn of the economy, there is still appears to be growth going on in terms of the organic market here. And if we were to look at in terms of kind of the breakdown here in terms of organic food sales, you can see that the fruit and vegetable categories here, the green up here tends to be the largest, and the green here is about, you know, roughly around 37% here in 2008. Next on line we would have our dairy here, you know, which is around about 16%, and then 13% here for some of our packaged and prepared, and breads and grains here being about 10%, and then on down here where you have about 5%, and then meat just only around 3% or so. But even though some of these categories are small down here, there's a fair bit of evidence that they're growing quite a bit as well during this time. So the other question is, I guess, you know, what is the organic price premiums? You know, these are things that I think, you know, vary a lot by product and by season. But when you're thinking of your market niche, what is it that you might be able to grow at a certain time period in a certain window where you can outcompete others in your area and maybe a broader scale as well, is something to keep in mind. You can see from, you can go to the Rodale Institute here, and there's one site that has some information here on current organic prices. And if we were to pull up and look at some of the things they might have here for like fruit, you can see this gives a list of what they have in terms of the certified here organic, and then also the conventional, and over here for vegetables, certified and conventional. And you can see the price premium varies quite a bit, and even in some cases here, like if we look down here towards our green cabbage, we can see that they have for the same weight here a conventional a little bit higher price than certified. So, you know, that's one of the risks to growing organically, is that, you know, you may not always get that high price premium. And I know some growers have said that they always, you know, wind up moving some of their organic into the conventional market just to move enough of the volume that they have. So you might not necessarily count on getting a price premium for everything that's grown organically. When we think of our niche here through direct marketing, I guess locavore probably comes to mind here. I guess this is kind of a new word that was out. I guess the New Oxford American Dictionary had it as the word of the year here in 2007, but it's a term that kind of originated in the San Francisco Bay Area. But in terms of being a person that seeks out the locally produced food there, and not only does it involve nutrition in terms of being better and, you know, locally for a better taste, but also kind of driven behind a locavore is someone who seeks to kind of like minimize the carbon footprint of the food that they consume so that they're minimizing kind of the impact here to the environment. The other thing I think of in terms of direct marketing is that there is also tends to be a really close connection of the consumer with the grower. It's kind of filling the gap there in terms of having a consumer that goes down to the grocery store and just picks their, you know, product off the shelf and puts it in the grocery bag. They don't really have a connection with where it's grown or anything. And that kind of goes back to the customer intimacy approach in terms of differentiating themselves with that consumer. Also, I think there's a lot of consumers that recognize that they, if they can support their local community environment and sometimes even the open space of the farm, that's something that they're willing to help support. And even some consumers would say, you know, that they feel that they're, when they can look at that producer in the eye and see where their food's coming from and know kind of the credibility of that grower, that they feel better about their food than just going into the regular supermarket and thinking, well, this came from a factory farm or something, and not knowing exactly what may be behind some of the safety issues of the food there. So when we look at direct farm marketing in terms of kind of trends where we've been going, I just thought I'd pull up here the Ag Census definition. And basically, the Ag Census here defines in 2007, for their 2007 census, did you produce, raise, or grow any crops, livestock, poultry, or ag products that were sold directly to individual consumers for human consumption? So you can see it includes the roadside stands, you know, pick your own, door to door, but it excludes things like, you know, processed items that might be jellies, jams, and hams. So in looking at what the value of their direct sales was, if we look at our Ag Census numbers here, we can see in terms of looking at all farms from 1997 here up through 2007 over here, that all farms here have essentially been about flat. They've actually decreased just a little bit. But farms that have actually been doing direct marketing or selling some directly to consumers for final end consumption there, it's increased about 2% annually here. So you can see they've grown from about 5% of all farms that do direct marketing to upwards of around 6.2%. And we look at farm sales, we can see that, you know, all farm sales have increased, you know, just a little bit above inflation over this period from 1997 to 2007. But direct farm marketing here sales have increased annually at, you know, over 7% here, you know, above inflation. And you can see just in terms of the amount of sales, it's still very small, you know, going from like 0.3% up to 0.41% of total sales. That's still a small percentage, but the growth is there. So, I mean, I think this is falls under the definition here of what we would call a niche market here. Now I'll pull you to a couple examples here, hopefully a little bit more interesting here, that are over here in the corner here of southeastern Arizona here, to look at some of the things that they've been involved with in what I would call some of the niche markets that they've worked on to develop. The first one here I'll look at is Apollani's Orchard here, and they kind of have an interesting story in the sense that when they looked to get into growing apples in the mid-80s here, they thought, you know, that they were going to, they apparently listened to the ag economists around, and they thought that they were going to make so much money they're going to need a truck to haul all their money. But what actually happened is when they took their apples, sold them to the packing shed the first year, the packing shed sent them a bill because the cost of the picking was more than the value of what they had for their apples. So they reevaluated and said, we got to do something differently here. So they got into the business of direct marketing, not necessarily by choice, but in some sense, just by survival. And as time went on, they were growing their business with their orchard in terms of their apples and pears and whatnot. They were marketing. There was another farm not too many miles away in the same area there that was also doing on the produce side a lot of vegetables that he was marketing directly. And when he put his farm up for sale, they realized that they needed to keep that farm and going because they had a lot of complementariness going and synergies between people coming out from the Tucson area going to, you know, this area to do some U-pick and whatnot. And they felt that if they didn't have this complementarity with their produce side, that they were going to be at risk in terms of vulnerability for the growth of their operation. So they went ahead and bought that operation. And you can see this is a sign at their produce farm there, Apollonius Produce and Pumpkins, where they have both U-pick and We-pick. So they have both commodities there available that you can have, and then they label things out in the field so that, you know, the consumers can have an idea exactly what they're picking and where they're at. If you look at just some of the experiences and things that they have there, they've got apple barn, they call, and then it's right next to this area here where you can have picnic tables under their peach trees. They've got kettle corn, homemade ice cream. And another thing they've added recently was a fudge kitchen. One thing, in listening to their story, you find that they've kind of shifted their kitchen from cider to actually fudge because of, just the economics associated with the situation. They weren't making much on the cider, and some of the other people they were in touch with across the country told them that fudge was a good gamble there, a good thing to do, so they got into some of the fudge, if you can believe it. They also do several value-added products here, and this allows them, I think, to minimize some of their risk in terms of just always having things ready there for the fresh. I know the U-pick is an important thing, and they usually always buy oftentimes their apples and things for their value-added products. They face certain risk, though, with the U-pick side in the sense of weather. I know one year they were pretty much rained out the whole month of October on all the weekends, and that, you know, was something that they remembered for a long time. And having some of these value-added products allows them to get, you know, different things into some of the stores, and also these are gift items in particular that a lot of people will buy locally for gifts for even Christmas time. A next farm here we'll take a look at. It's just down the road, actually, a little bit. And this is Briggs and Eggers Orchard. They have about a 400-acre orchard. They're larger scale, larger size than the Apollonius Orchard. They began, doing things organically in about the 90s there. And one of the things that they've had to work with in terms of being organically is develop a lot of the technology associated with the apple coddling moth. They've been involved with getting things so that mating disruption and a lot of that stuff, they've been kind of some of the pioneers in some of this area, so that part of their niche just comes back in terms of their cost efficiencies, and that comes back also, I think, in terms of their strategy to the future as well. They really tout, freshness as being something that they have that others do not have. And of course they, say getting that fruit in there within 48 hours is what they're after. And that's, their fruit does look good. The other thing they do is they also market a lot of their product here with New Harvest Organics. If you look here at this picture here, this is a picture of Briggs and Eggers Orchard and Mount Graham in the background. And they have kind of a real positive synergies here with their marketing outlet and their production. But the other thing that I'd like to note is that they also have a fruit stand here on their place. And at this fruit stand here, they also not only sell to people directly here, but they also sell to what Lance Eggers would call some of their peddlers, or people that they take their product to the farmers markets and locally. And what's interesting about this is they say that in about 1995, he said they really didn't have hardly any market for this here. They were just kind of getting started. But today it's about 10% of their market. And he's really glad in a sense because as Washington State's come on with a lot of organic apples and competition and stuff, he said this market here, this local market, is something that's been some, you know, paid them, held up well in terms of both the price and volume, and something that they're interested in growing with. So I think, you know, when you think of some of the niche marketing considerations, I think, you know, the local consumer aspect in having a reliable market is something to keep in mind. They can minimize some of the risks that you might face from some of the outside competition. And in this case, when you think of, you know, apples in southeastern Arizona, they're not even on the map compared to Washington State. So, I mean, he can compete effectively with them on the location. Cost efficiencies and good records. I mean, I think both of these operations are very much in terms of aware of what their bottom line is for all of these operations. And, you know, as the organic competition increased there, Lance would just say that they need to be organic, and they're going to continue on that front because they have to differentiate their product. And basically, he's looking at ways that he can cut costs down to outcompete others, people that are getting into organics. Apple Annie's, they essentially grow their apples organically, except for the fact that in their orchard, the people don't like weeds, so they do spray Roundup. And otherwise, if he could find a way to economically control his weeds, he said he would do certified organically, but he just can't find a way that he can do the weed control as effectively. And then, but he also markets directly, and consumers, they know in terms of, you know, the pesticides are not used, and that's important for his customers. The other thing I think is important to consider is the people skills here. Not only is it people skills for dealing with labor, because as you move away from commodity to more niche marketing, I think you just can't do everything all yourself. You have to be able to have labor that you can manage and rely on. Also, you have to be able to manage people on your farm in terms of people, if you're doing any UPIC or anything like that. That's something very important to be able to do, to assess your people skills as to whether this is something you can do, because a lot of commodity marketers, I don't think, have the personality to fit in with some of the direct marketing that goes on. Also, just think of, not only is your products being complementary with each other and what's on your farm, what kind of things is unique to your farm, but also, you know, is it complementary with other producers in the area? And some of the things in the Western profiles we found was a lot of producers that were able to team up successfully with others with similar goals and whatnot were important. I know even one case here in Tucson, there's a direct marketer of beef teamed with another direct marketer of beef because they don't want to spend all their time at the farmer's market, and they have a similar philosophy. So that has worked together there. And this is something here that John Newkirk here, or not John, but John Eichard has noted here, in the sense that your uniqueness is the only source of kind of your profitability that cannot be competed away. And it's just the sustainable part of having a niche market. And I think that's a good piece of advice to keep in mind, that your uniqueness here is what you're really selling for the long term. I just mentioned a few of these resources here with the Western Extension Marketing Committee been involved with, niche markets here, the Western profiles, and this certification and labeling considerations. If you go to valueaddedag.org, you can download these publications for free. There's also a lot of other resources out there in terms of, if we look at USDA, they have quite a bit of data here on organics. There's the National Organic Program, a lot in terms of the standards there. ATRA here with the NCAT, they have a lot of resources here available here on organics. The USDA Process Verified is a fairly new system here. The Never Ever 3 applies to a lot of livestock products in particular, but with no antibiotics or growth promotants or any animal byproducts, that's something there. Eat Wild, these bottom three here are kind of online sites for getting recognition from your site and recognition from some of the local consumers. And with that, that's everything I have, and look forward to questions that may follow later.
Russ, thank you. Don't go away. We got a couple questions for you while we query the audience. And thank you for excellent information. We've actually had a suggestion about the weed control issues. Someone said for weed control, they could apply some of the practice from and Bynes and Ovines, vineyard weed control project that uses sheep trained not to eat the grapevines. And actually the sheep have been trained using lithium chloride for aversion training. And another participant wanted you to possibly distinguish between wholesale prices. And they were making the point that wholesale prices are sale prices, not necessarily the prices paid to growers, although you want to comment on that just a little? And then I've got one other question for you.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I mean, they're not the price paid to growers, but I guess we'd hope that some of the premium there would also reflect back down to the grower, but it's true, it's not necessarily, yeah. On the weed control side, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's possible, yeah, you might be able to do some things with sheep and goats and whatnot. I know Eggers, they do a lot of weed whackers, basically, for their weed control. You know, I guess the difficulty with having animals out there as well, then you have another enterprise to try and manage, and you know, not necessarily all the weeds are 100% are gone. So that's one of the difficulties, trying to find a product that you can get, you know, 100%, essentially 100% control. Yeah.
One of our audience says third-party certification can be expensive for smallholders in specialty crops and organic. Got any suggestions on how they can handle that obstacle?
Yeah, I'd agree. And but there is the program now being offered through some of the departments of ag for a cost share on reimbursement of organic certification. Usually it's up to, you know, a cost share up to like 50%, up to, I think it's like $750 now or something like that. And there is also some EQIP monies available in certain areas for transition to organic assistance, although, you know, as to how much people are going to actually be able to get out of that, that's supposedly up to, you know, like $20,000 or something over time, or more than that. But you know, I think the total amount one would realistically expect to get would be less than that. But you know, definitely, I mean, it's not necessarily like the price premium there comes for free. I mean, you got to be able to go through the certification process, and I think that's one of the things, you know, where Briggs and Eggers feel that they have a competitive advantage. They know how to do that. They know where their costs are and where they can cut in order to still be competitive by meeting those requirements.
Questions keep flowing in for you, Russ, which we'll get to later. We're gonna give you a chance to answer one last question here, and we'll get back to the other questions that folks are entering. Really, thank you for doing that. They're strong questions. We'll come back to those, but I think you referenced a Rodale site where the premium prices for organic, the comparison to premium to organic and non-organic was put. Was that a Rodale site?
Yeah.
And I think if you just Google Rodale, R-O-D-A-L-E, you can work your way to that site. Would that be the suggestion? The other thing is they can review your slide set, which is up on our Ag and Uncertain Times website as well. Thanks, Russ. Stick around. We'll have time for some other questions.